Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
To feel it coming, do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are, and live with all your faults. I want to wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so I don't.
All right, Father's Day has just left the premises, and I don't know anybody who was a better son over Father's Day than Will Cozzettini. He joins me now. Are you enjoying, I mean, you've got a year as the greatest son in the country. are you happy about that?
Yeah, I'm just wondering what your motives here. Walk right in and say nice things about me. Now I'm on guard.
Well, No. It's not that I'm saying nice things about you, because your actions were pretty basic. So maybe this is a comment about everybody else, right? That not you weren't that great. You were just better than all the rest of the bozos I know.
Hey, listen, life really in many ways is relative. It's not on an absolute scale.
Right.
Right. You just got to be a little bit faster, a little bit smarter, a little bit better, so you don't get eaten by that bear. So
but you did drive to New York. You did drive to New York, and you drove back. Could you give us any insights in terms of the experience of driving across the country in the middle of this pandemic? You got a chance to see a number of different states, I would think, and people. So give me a couple insights.
Yeah, you know, so I live in the suburbs of Kansas City, which is right on the verge of rural Kansas. I stopped at a buddy of mine's house in sort of an urban suburb of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And the next morning we went down to a market area in Pittsburgh and had coffee. And in Pennsylvania, you got to have a mask to go into any business. And this market area was dead. And on the way there, he pointed out to me a few places that had closed up during the pandemic. So the geography of the place was very, very reminiscent of where I live. But the vibe was very different. And then I, driving up to New York, driving through central Pennsylvania, I had to stop for gas. And, you know, they got a big sign on the convenience store: all patrons must have masks. Well, I didn't have a mask. I walk in, nobody says anything to you. They serve you. No big deal. Then I got up to upstate New York, and where my parents live is, it's a rural county. Ithaca is there. I don't know how many people are in the city. I figure there's 20,000 students from Cornell, so there's got to be 30 or 40,000 residents in the city. There's 100,000 residents in the county, and last week they had 8 cases out of 100,000 residents. They've had 2 deaths in the county. Both of them were people who lived in New York City, whose children lived in upstate New York, so their children moved their parents up from New York City, and I think they were both nursing home people as it was, and they both passed away from COVID, unfortunately, in that upstate part of New York, although they weren't from there. So here's a county, pretty rural, 100,000 residents, 8 active cases, 0 homegrown deaths, same restrictions. You cannot go into any place of business without a mask on. And, you know, so I tested the boundaries a little bit. And I was in a liquor store for a while. And finally, we were checking out. A woman told me that I need to put a mask on. And it was interesting because I could tell she's not a native-born American. Some sort of Eastern European accent. But no one else in the store says anything to you. And then having a mask on and actually having an effective mask are two grossly, dramatically different things. So, and I heard your admonition to your listeners about you know, COVID's real, et cetera. But I got to tell you, Mac, if you're not doing operating room type infectious control, you're just kidding yourself, all right? 6 feet of social distance is irrelevant. Wearing the bandito over your face is irrelevant. So a lot of the stuff we're seeing out there is window wash. But it was strange for me because, again, the places I really stopped and spent time in look a lot like where I live here. But the vibe is very different on the East Coast than it is out here. So.
Well, and their experience was, you know, again, my experience colored by, you know, a good friend of mine lost his niece. And so she's the youngest person in Florida to have died from it. And so 17 years old. And so I mean, that's my comments reflect that. Like, I'm not a doctor. I play one here on the radio, and I don't know what's true. I don't know if the statement you make is valid, but the vast majority of medical doctors that I see, epidemiologists that I see and listen to, you know, say, hey, practice basic social distancing. And if you do that, you know, you should be okay. And so to me, that's not a message. And again, you and I have both lived a life where, you know, we've dealt with a lot of people that, you know, believe they're invincible. And, you know, the laws of motorcycles teach them otherwise, you know. And so I mean, I guess that's my message based on my own personal experience. It may be not being a doctor, it may be more from the heart than from the mind. So.
Yeah, I appreciate it. The other thing I'll say is anytime you get wound up and think that, you know, problems are universal and, you know, drive around the country. It's a big place. And it's, while the drive I took, you know, once you cross the Mississippi until you get to about eastern Ohio, it's pretty dull. There along Route 70. It's a lot of cornfields, which I like, except you see about 700 straight miles of it. It's a big country. Yeah. It's clean. People, for the most part, are genuinely nice out there. There's a lot of business going on. You can see just by the truck traffic out on the roads. It just gives you a different perspective than when you sit in your own house and watch TV. To get out and see some of the rest of the country, I hope it's a lot more resilient than it appears on TV sometimes.
I think it is. In one of the things I started doing before I left to go back to North Carolina was I stopped watching, other than when I'm doing my show, you know, I turned the TV off. And again, I've said this for, you know, for a long time. And the news that you see on TV at night and that you see on websites, that is the worst and weirdest shit that they can put in front of you that will get you to click, that they can translate to data to put in front of an advertiser that drives their revenue. That is what that is. That is not a reflection of, hey, let me tell you what happened in the United States today, okay? And everywhere you go, I just flew back and forth, you know, across the country. Everywhere where I went, people were absolutely awesome, right? Which is, I think, the narrative of the United States. They were helpful. It didn't matter who you were. It didn't matter what color you were. They were helpful, right? And I went from Denver to Atlanta to where else did I go? Denver, Atlanta, to Jacksonville, Charlotte, Dallas, Orange County. And everywhere I went, people were just, I mean, they were wonderful, to include my time spent in North Carolina. But that's not what we see on TV. What we see is the stupidest, you know, and it's not reflective of this country. And so to me, and I will tell you, though, a lot of people I deal with, you know, express a sentiment like, you know, this stuff's driving me crazy. Shut it off. Shut it off. Have very limit your news consumption to the Associated Press, to Reuters, to legitimate news organizations, not your Google news feed that is going to give you every stupid story that you've ever clicked on. So I think there's a part of mental health in there, because the news is, in my opinion, is a freak show and it's bullshit. So just one man's opinion about the news.
Yeah, and, you know, as a little feedback on that, as a battalion commander, when I would do the pre-deployment briefs for the families, the one thing I'd tell them is I'd say, look, if you want to be miserable, then watch the news all day, find some rumors, and pass them on. I guarantee you'll be miserable if you do that. And so taking some of my own – I mean, I haven't watched TV news really. The biggest doses of it I get is when I go to New York. This is my parents, because other than that, I don't watch it. But agree with you. Turn it off.
No, and I'll tell you what, I agree with you. If you want to have an awesome experience, get in your car and go drive across part of the country. And I had friends who were just down in Sedona over in Arizona. They went for a trip. I have other friends that went to Utah. And Utah has some absolutely spectacular things. I mean, you know, the landscape of the Grand Canyon of northern New Mexico extends up into Utah, and it's just breathtaking. I'm going to go for 9 days up to Montana and do post-traumatic winning 3 different times up there. And I'm fired up. I was just looking at the map last night. Fort Smith, a place called Nye in Montana, which is by just north of Yellowstone, and then up to Helena. But I mean, when you drive around, as Will said, you get a chance of the gigantic nature of the United States and its diversity. And that's why, you know, I laugh when I see this, we should have a national policy on face masks. You know, it's just like, okay. That's just a reminder to me to turn the TV off, okay? And because we have 50 states and a former government for a reason, okay? And so why don't we allow that to operate? And states are going to figure it the fuck out. They'll figure out how to live with this, you know, before we get a vaccine for it. And you can't shut down the economy. You just can't do that. So. You know, and young people are going to have a, you know, part of it. You're seeing cases in young people surge all over the country. Well, you know what? That's where it ought to be, right? That's where it ought to be because they can withstand it. So I just, the news again.
So what are we going to talk about? The news?
Well, I want to get your thoughts. I don't know if you read very much about the bounties. That yeah. story about the Russians, but I kind of did a deep dive into the Washington Post stories. There was two stories: one about the headline and the story itself. The other one was very particular about the intelligence that was driving all of this. So I'd be curious: have you read anything about it, and what are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, I read some of it, and so here's what I'm thinking. So let's just suppose that the Russians wanted to put in a bounty on U.S. servicemen. So how do they do that? Do they do that with low-level contacts with the Taliban? Or do they do that with a high-level contact with the Taliban? And then how do we find out about it? We find out about it through signals intelligence or human intelligence. If it's at a low level, that it's random noise in a certain part of the country. If it's at a high level, then that means that we've got some phenomenal sources at the high level. And then let me just think about why. I mean, are the Taliban motivated to kill Americans? Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. Does a Russian bounty get them to go out and kill more? I doubt it. If the Russians put a bounty on Americans, and the Taliban would be happy to collect it, but I think the Russians know that too. So it just seems to me when you get to the second or third question, it just sort of farcical. Could it be true? Yeah, but did Vladimir Putin develop a Russian Federation policy? That seems far-fetched to me. And then how did that intelligence come in? How does it get vetted? And what is worth getting into the president's daily brief? You know, and that's the big blow up of the story. And I compare and contrast a little bit to 2006, 2007 time period, when it was pretty hard intelligence that the Iranians were providing pretty advanced IED technology to the Shia militias in Iraq. And yeah, that was pretty well known at the time. And I just don't remember the furor about it. It was sort of on the news, and I didn't hear, I mean, I don't remember much about it. And then roll into the Iran deal later, I don't remember this sort of coming up. And that was pretty hard confirmed intelligence at the time. So this story, to me, is something that, I don't know, maybe some guy in the intel community heard a whisper of this and thought it's the biggest thing ever. And because it didn't make it through the vetting process, he leaks it out knowing that it's going to get a splash. That's my assessment of it.
You know, the other question is, okay, so what do the Russians have to gain from this? So
right.
They're going to spend several, you know, they're going to spend $10,000, $20,000. They're going to spend $200,000 on bounties for Americans. And then this is going to stay a secret, right? Wrong? Okay, this is going to get out. And so Taliban soldiers, low-level ones, when I'll give you a multiple choice question. When they're captured, they're stoic and never say a word and only give their name, rank, and serial number, or they sing like canaries? Which one would you choose?
Yeah, I would go with B.
So it's not, we can safely assume that it's not going to be kept a secret. So in exchange for $200,000 and several dead Americans or coalition forces, we're going to get our asses hammered by more sanctions by the Americans. Okay, look.
Well, beyond that, though, what is the incremental dollar amount that's got to motivate a low-level Taliban foot soldier to go kill an American? If he's motivated to do it, he's motivated to do it. And a dollar or $1 million or $100 million from Russians isn't going to get him to go do it more. It just doesn't, I don't know, it just doesn't seem to pass the...
As you said, the third question.
Yeah.
Right. Not that that would get in the way of it becoming a huge news story.
No. Okay?
Because we don't let the truth get in the way of what we now have defined as news. Okay. That we don't do. I had the same kind of when you go through the Washington Post two articles, again, written by, you know, one's a Pulitzer Prize winning intelligence report.
What's that got to do with it?
I'm just saying, so these are credentialed people. When you blow out the political quotes from it and you look at the intelligence assessment, to me, you know, it always gets interesting because just like post 9/11, you saw this, you know, this litany of reporting that said, you know, there were indications. Okay, show that report to me. Okay. Unsubstantiated informant, had never reported for, veracity unknown, and that in a stack of 9,000 other reports that day. Where does that data byte go? Now, in retrospect, that was the right guy, and that might be that was a part of the puzzle. But again, in that mosaic, that doesn't break squelch. It doesn't get into the brief. And yet you have people, you know, so I think this is more of that. It's when you get into the intel business, sources, veracity, you know, repeated, you know, what level the source is, and all the things that go into building this thing, you start looking at. And then the question is, my, as a guy asserts from CNA, I can, you probably know this guy by name because he worked for the chairman. His name is Carter Malkasian.
You know, I do remember that name, actually. Right.
And he said, you know, what are the odds that this was some regional program by, you know, some Russian operators that did it, right, and has is not connected to a national program, right? So, that to me seems like if there's an explanation as we begin to footnote this stuff, right, and that, you know, he ultimately says, if true, it could be a random program, one that reflects a well-coordinated program ordered by the highest levels of the Russian government. And so, again, because it doesn't get beyond three questions, I don't know.
Yeah, but what's the actual story now?
Oh, the story is a political one.
Yeah, it's what did Trump know? And if he didn't know, why is he so incompetent? If he did know, why is he protecting Putin? I mean, stop it. You know, that's the story. And what you should do is put your whiteboard up in your house there and see how many more of these are going to come out between now and November. You know, the more you can put in, and this has got bipartisan people all in uproar. And like I say, the Iranians were absolutely involved, and we should have taken a huge bite out of their ass in 2006, 2007. But we didn't. You know, that was a real story with real dead Americans back then. So...
when what's his name Soleimani got whacked.
Yeah,
I mean, I know people. I mean, I watched that video of that burning, whatever the hell it was, white vehicle at the airport. I had that thing on loop for a while. I mean, I was happy because those what were they, depleted uranium? What were those penetrator things that they made in Iran and shipped there and then trained everybody? We were living that life, and those things were horrible. They, you know, you could be in an up armored Humvee; it did not matter. They smoked right through those things.
Yeah, I don't think it was DU. It was like shape charge type
right.
stuff.
Right, they're shape charge. They were copper formed shape charges. And came from Iran, trained by Iran, probably in place by Iranians as well, and you know, until they got the Iraqis trained to do it. But you know, that went on, you know, through President Bush's presidency, through President Obama's, and it was not a secret their involvement, but we were all okay with that.
Yeah. So
interesting. All right, your turn. Give me a story to comment on.
Changing of the Mississippi flag. Did you see this?
Hello. I mean, I'm walking the planet. Yes, I saw it.
All right. I mean, here's what I thought about it. You know, whatever we talked a week or two ago, the whole bring down the monuments and the naming for Confederate generals. And I said, I don't want to die in a ditch over this kind of stuff. But I also don't want to surrender to the mob. Here's what I like about what happened in Mississippi. My history of the Mississippi flag might be a little bit flawed, but I think that they incorporated this in, you know, the late Jim Crow anti-civil rights era. But the Mississippi legislature on a single issue voted. They didn't tuck this into some bill that had to be passed so that you could lever people. They debated it over the weekend in public. And then they voted. And I think what that does is it sends it out to a referendum to the population in November about what the new flag will look like. So to me, it's not a enduring symbol, right? The Mississippi flag has been changed at least twice that I am positive of. It's done in daylight by elected representatives, and the people get to hold them accountable by one, voting on the referendum, and by two, voting on whether they continue as legislators in the future. So it's a, to me, it's a, it's a, if you're going to do something, it's the way to do it. And we'll see what the fallout from the left, right, and center, just about what they did and then about the process. But I thought interesting in the rule, you know, even in the midst of a mob, you can do things in a way things are supposed to be done.
Well, you know, I think we've all been waiting for that, right? When are mom and dad going to come home and say, okay, look, there's a way that we consider these things, whether it's statue or base names, and we have meetings, we have, and the people that are supposed to be running this stuff, they run it. And so let me just tell you, I had the same reaction to what they did. It's the way it's supposed to happen. It's the way this country does things. And to me, it gave me it was a little moment of joy, right, in a tsunami of just stupidity, it seems like, that people that have sworn oaths to support and defend the Constitution have decided to turn their back on that oath and the people that depend on them to execute that oath, that I'm going to allow parts of a city in Minneapolis to be taken over. I'm going to allow parts of a city in Seattle to be taken over. Well, what about the people that live there? You swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution. That's them. And so I agree with you. I was thoroughly heartened by that. And honestly, I think it's the first thing in a while that has sent a great message to the country. Like, look, Americans are good people, like, you know, like we were talking about earlier. When you meet them, when you're out there driving, you know. But again, what do we see, you know, what do we see dominating the news? Some asshole speedway owner in North Carolina or something that made some comment about a noose. I mean, that is blessed. Some idiot, some random idiot that probably has drank too much of that firefighting foam in his life. Right, and he's the guy that's dominating the news cycle today because of some comment he made about a news. Are you shitting me? And that's what I hate about our national news. It is the hottest. It is the most bloviating. And then when you see something like that, where is the op-ed that you just wrote, Will? Where is the op-ed around the country that says, you know, a tip of the cap to politicians in the state of Mississippi for getting it right? You know, not only, you know, whatever you agree with the or disagree about the outcome, but the process is what is important in the United States of America. Thank you for reminding us all. Where's that op-ed?
And I'll tell you, you are not going to see this at the federal level, right? Because these people took a single issue, debated it in public, and then voted in public. On a federal level, anything that gets done is going to get buried in some other bill. If they want to change the base names, if they want to change the names of buildings at the Naval Academy, if they want to remove statues, it's going to be buried in some other must-pass bill so that people can't be truly held accountable and the public can't see what they've done. So, I won't give you my view on the outcome of this thing, but process-wise, that was pretty unbelievable to see. So,
why won't you give us your opinion on the outcome? What are you?
Well,
Are you playing hard to get, or what?
No, I've given some. I think that the symbol in that flag was, a thumb in the eye to the anti-segregationists in the 60s. I haven't done my research on it. So it was
right.
It was not done in a spirit. You know, it's interesting. I think Florida's flag is based on a Confederate flag, not the Stars and Bars. And I think there's another state flag out there as well that's based on a Confederate flag.
Which is, what is it? Like the Cross of St. Andrew or something like that?
It's that flag with the red diagonal crosses on it on a white background. I believe, and I'll get out on a limb here, I believe was used in certain Confederate flags back then.
Yeah, if you look at if you look at Alabama's flag, is the cross of St. Andrew, which is, you know, red and white, diagonal cross, right? Right off the Confederate. Florida is the same.
Yeah,
so you see, and so, yeah, it, but I'm with you. I like the process, and I think, and that's the debate and the discussion that the nation needs to see and have, I think.
Yep.
I had another follow-up question about that that I was going to ask. And I was going to ask you a civil military question. Shit, and it was a really, really good, insightful question too. I know it's that's not going to shock you, but it was another one, which is amazing. The all right, which role is ascendant for a retired military officer that serves in a political administration? So you straddle two worlds. You are an accomplished military officer, and somebody asks you, in theory, to serve in an administration. You leave that capacity. I saw an interesting op-ed. In your opinion, what role should be the ascendant role? Because you're still retired general. Thoughts on that?
So you're saying you're still in the administration?
Or no. You're out of the administration. Either another election's happened and you've gone peacefully, or you've been replaced or whatever. But you're out. What is the ascendant role in your life? Are you now a retired politician? Are you a retired general, or are you some hybrid thing?
Yeah, I think a little bit depends on the role and how much of a partisan you were in the role. You can. I guess by definition, if the president appoints you, almost all those roles are partisan roles, but some right. of them are a lot more partisan than others, and you can act in a lot more partisan fashion than others. When you go back, you're always a little bit poisoned by that partisan job that you held. And so if you're loyal to that partisan job, you're seen as a partisan by the opposition. And if you're not loyal to that partisan job, all of a sudden you get strange new respect from the people that used to be your partisan opponents, which should tell anyone, be very, very, very careful. If you're a retired senior, flag level guy that gets into in the executive branch in a partisan state. If you run for office yourself, you are a partisan in my mind forevermore. And then trying to wrap yourself in the mantle of the retired uniform guy, and I don't care which side of the partisan divide you're on. That's my uniform too. And I was apolitical in my time. And so now you wrap yourself back in that, and you soil it a bit by being a partisan. So,
Is your ascendant, is your primary role as a retired general officer, or is your ascendant role as a retired? Now you cross into this other murky world. Are you now a politician? And can you give me an example of somebody? You know, for instance, Jack King's pretty visible, right, as a TV commentator. He talks about policy and issues, right? Got out as a 3-star. But I think he does it in a way that I think is respectful and responsible and doesn't violate his oath or what he is. Can you give me an example of somebody who you would think that does it well?
Does it well in the current environment?
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think. The people that I primarily my contact with this kind of stuff is on LinkedIn because I'm not on Facebook. The people that don't do it well are Stavridis, Petraeus. I'm trying to think who else is on there, and they're partisan. They hide behind the uniform, but in a very partisan manner. neither of them were in Petraeus was in administration. Stavridis was not. I don't see Keane on TV. If you could get on there and comment in a way that you're describing for the listener or viewer process and how decisions get made. So when you see a decision get made, you know, if he can tee up how the debate may have gone in the National Security Council, that would be of interest. Or how different tribes within the military or the national security apparatus would see different things and what their what their interests would be, right? State Department has a different interest than people in DOD than in the CIA. That is a helpful thing that a senior retired military person could do. But I would want to walk a very, tightrope in that I'm not commenting on the results of that per se, because then you get into this partisan debate and you're also taking space away from the people who are currently in those positions. When you question how something comes out that can be a direct affront to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the chairman's job is to go in there and give best military advice and then execute what the boss tells him to do. And so you give him less room if you come out in a partisan way, as particularly if you're a retired chairman. So I think it's...
Well, and again, I think that just the events of this past month have shown how problematic that is. I mean, when you saw people... I think reacting to events they saw in D.C. and speaking out about it, to include General Mattis, to include General Allen, to include
Admiral Mullen
and et al. The what to me was implicit in that is we don't believe that Milley and Esper are up to this. That was to me implicit in the communication. And I don't, to give an example to your words, which ultimately makes their life more difficult.
Yeah. And, it's interesting. You didn't hear the just retired chairman say anything. The only other chairman who didn't weigh in on this is General Pace.
Which brings us to, the next issue. And so, and then you can go twice. General Dunford in the news these days. Have you seen?
I saw a leak to ABC News about how there's something in the CARES Act that they want to get involved in. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, there's, and this gives you some idea of, talk about somebody who would be held in high regard, right? And the headline I saw was Pelosi McConnell eyeing former Joint Chiefs chairman to chair Congressional Oversight Commission. Dunford in the final stages of vetting his appointment would come after the commission has remained leaderless for months. And under the terms of the CARES Act, commission chairman is a joint pick between House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. The two have struggled to come to an agreement about the individual who would be acceptable to both parties and also not have conflicts of interest that would preclude taking the position. People familiar with the situation spoke on condition of anonymity, cautioned that the appointment is not final. Dunford will still go through a final review process. A representative for Dunford declined to comment. But again, this would be the person who's the oversight person for the CARES Act, and
let's just think about this for a second. So the Democratic legislative leader and the Republican legislative leader got to get a joint nominee. The CARES Act is a financial, it's how we're spreading money around to keep the economy going after Corona. So it's a financial thing. So they can't find someone they agree on, so they go to a retired military. And so if that retired military person who's already just been leaked, right, they've already leaked. So I'm not sure what that leak is about. Has he been reticent in taking this and people are leaking him to try and make him look bad? Or does somebody not want him in this position so they're leaking it? So now you go in and it's a five-person commission and it's two Republicans and two Democrats. How much shit do you think they're going to agree on?
So why would you put yourself in this situation?
So how many times is your vote going to break the tie?
Oh, every
50,
time.
50, 60, 80, 90%.
Yeah.
And so what's going to happen to the people that you vote against? What do you think that they're going to be good, solid Americans and
yes.
they're going to come in and fight and lose? Or do you think they're going to leak this thing in the worst way?
And assassinate you because you don't agree with them? Why would you think that?
I know.
is that your glass half empty?
That unfortunately is my three tours in the Pentagon coming at him right there.
Whoa! If you were on, I don't know how General Dunford rolls right now, but a representative for Dunford declined to comment. My instinct is that was his wife, Ellen. Okay.
I think she would have been a little more profane.
So if you were advising him, what would you say?
Well, here's the thing. The man is an absolute patriot. And at some point, the government's got to function and good people got to step up to the plate and do certain things, right?
Right.
But all that being said, and normally when you say but, everything you said before but is all bullshit. This is, I read up on the CARES Act, this is like a five-year commission. This is 5 years of agony because you're going to have four people in the room that you really don't know. And what leverage have you got over them to keep them in line? Look, we want to have open, honest debates. We distribute some funds. Here's what we think, how it went, blah, blah, blah. And someone says, well, I don't agree with that. I know. Cause, so we vote. It's 3-2 against you. And so then that guy go plants a bomb out in the press. And what can you do against him? I mean, I have one experience with this where I was involved with a presidential mission in a foreign country that we had to collect information and write reports on. And I collected information from all across the interagency. And I told him, you're going to give me information and you're going to get nothing back from me. And they said, well, we're not doing that. I said, fine. But my boss is a hell of a lot bigger than your boss and is going to spank you. And so they had to comply. But it's the only way that thing couldn't get leaked is that I wrote the report myself. And I handed it to someone who handed it to a cabinet official. It couldn't get leaked. And it's the only mission that dealt with this part of the world that never got leaked. So, you know, whoever's going to get this job is going to go in and hire a professional staff. It's going to be 20, 30, 40, 50 people. It's going to be... You might have some people loyal to you, but you got to find some experts. You don't really know them. You don't have a lot of leverage over them. And that stuff, this is likely to be controversial, and that stuff is going to get leaked. And you're going to be up there testifying before Congress and having someone call you all kinds of different names. I don't know.
So you sound like were you to advise, you would say respectfully decline?
If the general, a man who I genuinely admire and respect, was to ever call me for my advice, I would keep that between the two of us.
Oh, listen to you. Well, let me tell you, I'll go out on a limb and tell you, I think I might know what it would be, right? And you know, I mean, it's not going to pay a whole lot. It's federal service.
Yeah, but listen, the man, like I said, he's a patriot above all else. The monetary side of it, I'm not going to walk in his shoes. I don't think that's the relevant. It's is what impact can I have to get something done properly versus the unbelievable ass pain of having to be in Washington, D.C. some certain amount of time.
Oh, and to be in that specific position where every vote is, you know, 4-4 and 2-2 and me.
Yeah, and if it crosses the threshold of duty to the nation and importance, you know what? I got a feeling I know how it'll go. And if it comes into this is partisan rigmarole and you two idiots ought to be able to find someone else to do this. Or you never know. There might be other mitigating circumstances. I'm not walking in his shoes. And I'm not living with the former Miss Santucci, who she can pack a wallop too.
All right, your turn.
Here's a good media level story. Soccer kneelers. The whole U.S. team kneeled during the national anthem, female. And
I thought it was the National Women's Professional League, but not the there were members of the national team, but they were playing for their own league.
Whatever. The beauty of the story is the commentator, the guy who's always on there, Alexi. Whatever his name is.
Oh, Lawler? That did the big, tall, redheaded dude.
Yeah, he comes out and says, you know, it might take more courage to stand during the national anthem than kneel.
It no shit does.
And he got slaughtered for that and had to walk it back. And again, it's interesting to me because in the end, nobody cares if women's professional soccer players kneel. I'll be intrigued to see what happens when baseball starts up, if they even play the national anthem anymore, or if football starts up.
Let's just have a moment of silence so you could do whatever you want. If you want to keep drinking your beer and sit down, you can. If you want to, you know, right? If you want to kneel down, you could do that. If you want to stand up, bow your head, and pray to the Almighty, you can do that too. It's kind of like do your own thing moment.
But having a moment of silence, that's got to offend somebody.
No, it will. Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
You talk about, though, one of the most woke sports, women's soccer.
Oh, it's totally a woke.
And the commentator can't help himself. And it's, you know why it's called a gaffe when he says something like that?
A gaffe is a fishing implement or that has a hook in it, right?
But it's also when you state an obvious truth
in
the face of the narrative. That's a gaffe.
Oh, that's a gaffe.
It's more courage to stand.
Well, if you look at the picture, okay, that I saw, there's somebody on a knee, there's somebody with their arm around somebody, and there's one soccer player that's standing up behind them. And I had the same thought, like, I don't know who she is, but whoever she has no small amount of intestinal fortitude. Because it's not like that wasn't going to be scrutinized, right, by teammates and by everybody, you know, all the people that were going to see it and that were there that day. So, yeah. Now, I just – and honestly, I'm sick of it. You know what? Here's the question. Remember I told you I had a really substantive question and I had forgotten about it? And this has to do with – goes back to the Mississippi flag thing. And that is this. Are we ultimately going to have a dialogue about being a nation of imperfect people? You know? That, you know, and our history is cluttered with imperfection. You know? Or do we act like a totalitarian regime and sandblast our history?
Yeah, I think we're going to find out in November. I think that's just one of the choices.
Whether we sandblast it or we have a dialogue about we are a nation of flawed human beings.
Yeah, because the mob is winning a lot of these things. you know, Princeton changing the name of the Woodrow Wilson School. I don't know how Yale and Stanford survive
right.
this sort of thing going forward. I don't know if, you know, that attempting to pull that Andrew Jackson statue down and, you know, now we got the FBI looking for guys, I guess, who did it. So we're making a federal crime out of vandalism. I mean, I guess it's more than vandalism. I don't know if that's enough to stop. I don't know, but this is just one of those things because, you know, if the president loses, and particularly if loses a majority in the Senate, then who is standing up and saying, hey, let's think about some of this stuff and talk about it? There's no one doing that. And so the administration and the legislature is got the hard left side of that mob has just got a lot more influence and energy on these kinds of things. And so we'll see. The national debate, I don't know how you have a national debate on that topic other than the history is there. You can be interested in it or not, but it is real. And you can't make it go away. And then there's the other side of it is it all has to go away. I don't think there's a majority of the country. That
but again, it, so if we, what I saw something that was, you know, I guess the first thing I saw was indigenous people pulling down Father, you know, Juniper Cerro's statue in Los Angeles. I think it was. It might have been San Francisco. I'm not sure which city it was, but they toppled his. You know, he was the founder of the California Mission Systems system. You know, a Spanish, you know, priest. And so, but then, I mean, isn't the whole act of the United States aggression against Native Americans? I mean, so the whole premise is simply an expansion of this idea that, you know, that somebody, you know, somebody was set upon and preyed upon. And so to me, as you look at the narrative of the United States, that's the world's narrative. You're strong and you win, or you're weak and you're conquered. And if you're conquered, you tend to get exploited. You know, so I don't know if this is going to lead to, you know, a very, very interesting dialogue about you know, how nations are formed and that people are imperfect and that whole narrative. And then what do we do about their imperfections? Are some okay? Is Martin Luther King's infidelity to his wife okay? But other people's, you know, crimes are not? Who gets to draw that line? So,
yeah, and look, if people were interested in learning those things, then you want those statues and monuments there because it makes you have the conversation. I mean, I've read several biographies of Andrew Jackson. He's an interesting guy. There's things in there that resonate down through how the country does business that came from Jackson that are still there today. And there's other things in the guy that, you know, he's a reprobate. But so what? He was a president, you know, in the 1830s. By having a statue and make someone, you can learn about it. When you go to Gettysburg, think if the place is just whitewashed. No, you go there and you study it and you learn more about what happened with the 20th Maine, you actually learn a lot about the country and what those people thought, what they were willing to do, maybe what some of them didn't know and were doing. But you take all that away, and then what does it become? It becomes this blank canvas that people want to put things on, which means it's complete political mumbo jumbo, people driving a certain agenda. If people were interested, then we leave those things up and you can, that helps you have the conversation. And the other thing I'll say, I don't know. I hear people say, well, because I see that statue, you know, it's so offensive every day. I don't know. I just say, get over it. Be a better person yourself. Say you're going to go make a better environment.
Yeah, that's why, to me, I would like to see, you know, all those, you know, does that statue bother you? Well, have you stopped and looked at it? And then, to me, that's why you build it out. You tell the rest of the story. Get informed, right? Learn about it, all right? To include who put the statue up and why. And then, you know, and why we're telling the rest of the story. Because, you know, this is a flawed nation. Those political deals that are put together by politicians, right? Inherently flawed human beings, you know? Yet that's our path, whether we like it or not. And, you know, so, you know, it's better to look at it in the harsh light of day. And again, communities will decide for themselves whether they want to retain them, but do not destroy them. Because if you destroy the narrative of a people, to me, you are, as greater people than me have said, you are doomed to repeat it. What is tyranny, right? What is tyranny? Well, it looks a lot like what we're living through right now, when people are afraid to speak, you know, and I think Timmy said it, you know, I don't know when he said it, either last week or the week before, but the people who do this stuff, are the Taliban, are China, are the Chinese, right? You don't talk about Tiananmen Square.
Right.
It's illegal. You cannot do that. They've written it out of their books. Is that a good thing? Is that the way you treat your history? And in my opinion, the answer is no. Not only no, but fuck no, you don't do that. You tell the whole ugly story and you move on to be a better culture, a better organization, and better people. So it's painful. Yeah. And I think it ultimately goes there because now you're seeing, I think, guys, like I read something, I saw a headline and read a couple paragraphs of something John Stewart said. Right, Bill Maher even said, "Yeah, this is stupid. Okay, we need to stop it." And so, when you have people like that that are beginning, and a lot of it comes out of comedy historically, so we shall see as this moment, you know, the nation partly endures, you know, partly watches, and then I think begins to, you know, hopefully assert what is right in America, and that is due process, freedom of speech, and those things that we should all hold dear and we should all defend and that should take us to where we need to go as a people. But pretty uncomfortable watching some of this shit.
Yeah, I mean, I consider myself very lucky in that the amount of the world I've been able to see. And you go and see great old buildings and monuments and things to people that you just don't believe in or the process, but it makes you learn about it, and it's interesting, and it gives you a perspective, and also it makes you appreciate the United States, without a doubt. But yeah, when the Taliban blew up those Buddhas, however many years ago, the absolute outrage across the world about that, and now here we are. And we don't have 1,500-year-old Buddhas that were blown up, but significant things to the history of the country that the mob, the uneducated mob, pulls down. We're going to see.
I think that's the scariest, right? The scariest piece of all of this is. And you've seen this started, you know, with the riots in Berkeley when conservative speakers would show up. And you've seen surveys of young people, and they were asked, do you have the right to stop them from speaking? And the answer was, yes, I absolutely have the right. I don't agree with them. I have the right, and the duty, the responsibility to stop them from speaking.
But here's something interesting too. Like I said, the only social media, I guess you could say, I'm on is LinkedIn, and I've seen this probably three or four times in the last several weeks. And the statement is words of the effect of, if you are not in support of BLM and these things, then you should just unlink from me now. It's not worth my time to be connected with you. And so, I've heard things about people on Facebook getting in, you know, spats with family, and all of a sudden they unfriend them. So people that are talking about tolerance and diversity, and LinkedIn is supposed to be sort of a professional business thing, are unwilling to be associated on a business sort of colleague level with people that don't think exactly what they think. That's not healthy. But I'll tell you, that's social media. Social media does not make you get face-to-face and discuss things. Social media is about snark, you know, and bumper sticker politics.
Yeah, I think it promotes cowardice, right?
Big time.
Right. Let me tell you, when Will and I have both had this experience, you know, professionally. You know you're going to a meeting, and you know it's going to be on in front of God and everybody in this meeting. And you see who shows up, and the other thing you see is who can do that in a respectful manner, right? But you know it's going to happen. You adamantly, you know, believe that, you know, what somebody else is advocating is not good for the organization, and will lead to failure. And so it's like, all right, we're going to do this in public. Well, here we go. And to me, I mean, there's courage involved in that. And then there's you know, it's look, I've done this before, right? I know that I'm gonna have to do business probably with this person on the back side of this. So, you know, as much as I, you know, as powerful as I feel about my position, you know, I'm no stranger to this rodeo. I can do it in an articulate way, in a responsible way, so that at the end of the day, I can walk out of there with my head up and all of that. None of those rules seem to apply in all of this. It's just burn it down, you know, whatever. And again, that energy will spend itself. That energy will spend itself. And I will tell you that it will be interesting this 4th of July, I believe, as police departments all over the country take a step back and say, you know what? Not worth my career. Not worth my life. As activists say, we're dying for more. For more powerful video. We need that. We got to go out in the street and we got to get it, right? And that means we got to confront the police and we got to do this. And there's no doubt in my mind that there's people around this country that are having those discussions and planning that. But, you know, I think it should concern us all, some of the statistics we're seeing coming out of major urban cities. And, I mean, what do you think it's like to be in a police unit right now?
Well, it depends. You know, Oklahoma City. The DA went out and indicted people for terrorism. And the chief, I'm not sure if it was the chief or the head of the union, was all about it. And he says, we know that when we go out there, the DA's got our backs. And when people do things, he's going to go after them. I think the Oklahoma City Police Department is going to be out there. If you're the New York Police Department, yeah, what can you do?
Not so much.
Yeah, and who pays the price for that?
People in the tougher parts of towns that will be more susceptible to that violence.
Yeah, because you don't think that the criminal enterprise, and I'm not talking the political criminal enterprise that wants video, but you don't think the criminal enterprise is going to get right in the draft of this stuff. And scores get settled and targets get taken down, you know, while everyone's focused on someone spray painting on a freaking statue. Criminals aren't necessarily the smartest people in the world, but they're not stupid.
Right.
You're going to have all the police stepping back and get involved somewhere else.
Give me one thing to read. Doesn't necessarily have to be a book you're reading. Give me something to read.
So book, but it's been going. It's a World War II book I got, which is actually quite good. I'll tell you, a site that I actually have been going to a lot lately is called the Powerline Blog.
Powerline Blog?
Yeah, P-O-W-E-R line, L-I-N-E, blog. And there's a guy up in Minneapolis who puts something up almost every day on it. There's been some good insightful stuff. And they link back to different people. So that's a site that I've been getting news from, news and commentary lately. How's that?
No, that works. That works. I'm still stuck on the Wall Street Journal. I know I sound like a broken record, but I would tell you, I've thoroughly enjoyed, in my opinion, not only the reporting that they do, which I think is the best you will find in the world, dare I say, but I've also thoroughly enjoyed, their opinion pieces throughout all of this. I mean, and talk about, I don't know too many months what you've seen between COVID and the Floyd murder and all the things that we've seen and the reaction of the nation, where you've seen a more fertile time for the op-ed people that write op-eds. I mean, it's like belt-fed op-eds that come out, and they're of weighty issues, and I think of issues fundamental to the democracy. In a day and age where the landscape is changing, where the truth doesn't matter, where social media companies can't decide whether they're content providers or platform providers. And if the content doesn't sync up with, the liberal media's interpretation of what it should be, now all of a sudden we're going to get into the content policing business. Well, those are fundamental questions, for the democracy, because more and more, especially young people, get their news from those sources. So I just think it's I've thoroughly enjoyed the platform, and I've been traveling, so I've been tending to read shorter things while I'm traveling and things like that. So Will, first of all, I appreciate you doing this, man. I always enjoy it. Thank you for the discussion this morning, in your case, in the midday. And have a great Monday. Any big plans for the 4th of July? Going to go back to New York and see your dad? Be another good
No, I have a friend who's doing a remodel in her house, and so over the weekend I provided constructive criticism and commentary, and I'll probably do some of that next weekend as well. Oh, as opposed to doing any real work.
Oh, you don't do the work; you just do the.
Come on!
You're a working guy. You're an upstate New York guy. It's not like you're a New York City guy.
No, I you can imagine my constructive criticism and the value that brings. And then I took him out to dinner. So,
well, there you go. Okay. Yeah. I can accept that. All right, bud. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. See you, Mac.
There you have it. Will Costantini. He's a smart guy. And, I like doing that. I like doing that. I really enjoy doing it with him. Will is a thinker, and what I've learned from Will tends to step back and then he'll ask these fundamental questions. You might be dazzled by some shiny part of the discussion. Will is great at, he steps back and he asks a fundamental question about the whole root purpose of what you're doing. And then all of a sudden he asks that, and you're like, okay, wait a minute, let me step back and do that. I enjoy doing this with him. So my thanks to him for coming on today. All right, if you're just tuning in, I had an experience over the weekend. Well, last week, And it has to do with, I'll give you the title of the post for hour one. And that is this: when the landscape changes and you don't, culture, leadership, counseling, and outsourcing in the military, and suicide. So it talks about, the story talks about or hour one talks about my experience with post-traumatic winning, right? And defined by the people I've met, who I got to see a bunch last week of them, and that was awesome. They're doing great. The basis of that is me getting to know them, right? The conversations that we've had. And so if that's what it takes, how do you institutionally get there? Now, the problem institutionally is this. Probably 80% of the people that counsel younger Marines that are just getting on their feet, they're away from home, they're novices too. You know, the lieutenants who are in the operational forces are going to have less than 3 years of, you know, all are going to have less than 3 years of experience unless they're prior enlisted, which case they'll have more. The sergeants are going to have less than 5-6 years of experience. And so if you listen to General Mattis say, if you don't love them, you really ought to get out. If you listen to General Furness say, the secret of all of this, making suicide and destructive behavior numbers go down, is you've got to know them better. Okay, you've got to know them better. Okay, and I talk about how that's like 75 years of leadership experience between the two of them and about 12 to 14 combat deployments, something like that. It's a lot of wisdom. So you're asking novice leaders to perform. We want leadership 801 from them, but they're at 101 and 201 level leadership. How do we get them to 401? What is the training? What are the tools that we give them? You know, and how do we to get them to 401? Knowing that if we can get to 401, we can continue to force that trend line down. So talk about that in hour one. And then we talk about, I go through the Russia, Taliban bounty thing. And it was interesting. Will and I's thoughts on it are pretty similar. You start to look at it and I don't know whether it's just the little that we've seen, because we don't get to see anything on what's known as the high side anymore, classified side. But, you know, so this program done by Russia to kill a few Americans that's going to cost, you know, maybe a few $100,000, and potentially, if this gets leaked to the United States, we're going to pay for it in billions of dollars of Russian economic activity. I mean, look, I'm not in Vladimir Putin's inner circle, but, you know, I mean, were I and I sitting at that table, the answer would be not only no, but fuck no. They're leaving. If you haven't noticed, Trump's getting out of this son of a bitch as fast as he can. Why would we do this and hurt ourselves? And whose idea was this? So I think there's more to be written about the story and talk about that as I go through both stories in the Washington Post. One is the story about the intelligence that exists about it. And the other one is and I think the questions about that, you know, is, was this a local program run by some wayward idiots in the Russian military? Or was this sanctioned by somebody in the Kremlin? I honestly. But again, that's the truth is separate and apart from what will happen to it politically. And what will happen to it politically Yeah, stand by for that. So, have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow. Grant Newsom going to join us tomorrow here it'll be a holiday week coming up, a short week, and here on All Marine Radio. So, and then I think that you're going to hear from somebody who I cross paths with on, I think you'll hear from them on, I think you'll hear from them sometime this week. I'm not kind of exactly sure when, but somebody that I cross paths with on my most recent trip to North Carolina. So have a great day. This program continues right now, and it's up on the website if you'd like to check it out there. So we'll see you tomorrow on a Monday, All Marine Radio, over and out.